Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org.
All right, welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I am Matthew Gage. This is lesson number 21 in a series on the book of Revelation. We'll be covering chapter 20 today. And I'm recording these out of order for the benefit of some friends of mine, the Bitskos, who moved away when I was teaching through this. So I'm recording these last few first, so I'm kind of doing things backwards for the book of Revelation, and hopefully we'll get around to recording the previous 20 lessons at some point. But I'm going to pick up here and finish off these last few lessons for them. So kind of anticlimactic. I'm getting the climax of the story first. But anyway, we'll be in chapter 20 of the book of Revelation. And this lesson I've titled The Final Victory. And what we have here is really a lot of stuff, prophetically speaking, is just glossed over. There is the theory that sometimes expressed in prophecy that the prophecy is mountain peaks, and you don't see the valleys in between the mountain peaks. You only see the high points of prophecy, and that comes into play when you're talking about the, especially with the first and second coming of Christ. There are prophecies in the Old Testament that have them seem like they are one and the same, or connect the two, but do not put the space of 2,000 almost or plus years that are involved in there. So in this chapter, it's kind of a similar deal. What's glossed over here is the idea of the millennial kingdom, which is a key and central topic in biblical prophecy. This is... And part of this, you have to realize, in the book of Revelation, the book of Revelation is written for the church. It's not necessarily written for with the Jews. It really takes a very church-centric approach to the tribulation period. Even the tribulation period, we can go back to the Old Testament and talk about. But when it comes to this chapter, you can tell in its approach to the millennial kingdom, not a lot of emphasis is given. Whereas, if we go back to the books, say like the book of Isaiah, there is a lot of information, a lot of prophecy, a lot of time spent on the millennial kingdom. But here, it is just glossed over, barely even mentioned. So, to set the stage, coming from chapter 19, we had the second coming of Christ, what we would call the battle, the campaign of Armageddon, and Christ's victory. He has now come to set up his kingdom, to rule and reign on earth. There is the detail. In fact, I'm going to cover just a few quick notes on the millennial kingdom, just to set the stage for what's going to happen, because like I say, it's just glossed right over in the first few verses of this about the first half of the chapter, and it's not a lot of details given on the millennial kingdom. During this time, we're going to find out in this chapter that it is for 1,000 years. That is a detail that is, I believe, is not given in the Old Testament, even though there are prophecies relating to this time period. This will be for 1,000 years. Satan himself is bound. He is incarcerated. He is restricted. He will not be present, will not be active during this time, at least for the majority of it. He'll be released at the very end. We'll get to that in a minute. What's going on earth during this time? Well, we have had the defeat of the Antichrist, of Satan's forces, and Christ has reestablished a kingdom on earth. Its capital is in Jerusalem. Go to, for instance, the book of Zechariah, chapter 14, verses 4 through 11. Talk a little bit about this. This is fulfillment of promises to Israel, the promise that God made to David, that one of his heirs would rule forever on the throne, that prophecy is fulfilled in this, and that Christ is ruling and reigning. In fact, there are a lot of promises that are made to Israel about having a place and having a land and having this glorious kingdom that revolve around this time period. Isaiah chapter 11 talks a little bit about that. 2 Samuel chapter 7 verses 10 through 13 is where God talks about promises David that, you know, one of his descendants would rule and reign. So there, okay, what else we got here? What else is going on during this time? I'm going to get sidetracked here. I want to get this covered and get on with the what's actually here in chapter number 20. What's going on at this time? Well, we see that the state of the earth itself has changed somewhat. Go to Isaiah chapter 65, verses 18 through 25 for an example there. This is where verses that talk about the like the lion laying down with the lamb and the child playing with the snake and different things like that, cockatrice in the King James. Those verses are fulfilled during this time. And what I contend is that during this time, we revert, the earth itself reverts back to a pre-flood state, a near-perfect state, a Garden of Eden almost state. It's not pure, it's not perfect, but it is, shall we say, ideal. And there are some verses, I don't have the references right here in front of me, but there's verses that talk about people dying at advanced age and still counted as young. So these things are going on this time. I think that, and I'm sure if you're listening to this, and I've actually recorded all the previous lessons, you will have heard me say, and if not, you can look forward to that if I ever record them, that during the book, during the tribulation period, not only is there judgment, but there really is this idea of reshaping and recreating the earth, I believe, that is going on during that time period to set up this wonderful state of affairs, this wonderful state of being, this wonderful environment that we'll have during the millennial kingdom. Now, during this time, we're going to see here as we get going in Revelation chapter 20 that during this time, Christ is going to rule and reign upon earth. He's not going to be absent. He will be here physically. He will be active, ruling with a rod of iron is an image that it's often given of this time period. We as the saints will be ruling and reigning with him. We will see here in just a few minutes. So we have all this stuff going on during this millennial kingdom. This is a very, very important time. Like I say, this is very, very important when you go back and you look at Old Testament prophecy dealing with this. There are books written on just on this subject, and it's a very key subject in Old Testament prophecy. In this chapter in the book of Revelation, there's a few new little details, little nuggets like it lasting 1,000 years that are given. And then even what follows after is talked about in a little bit greater detail. But this time period is really just glossed right over. There's not a lot of information given to it. So I feel like I need to, you know, tap the brakes before we go any further and just explain a little bit about how important this millennial kingdom is, how important this concept is, how important it is as fulfillment of prophecy going all throughout the Old Testament, even in the New Testament. We could go back. Christ even talks some about this. This is a very, very, very important subject that is in the book of Revelation just glossed over. We spend so many chapters and so much time going over a 7-year tribulation period and just a few words going over, just a few verses going over this 1,000-year period. So, all right, let's go ahead and let's get started in verse number 1. Now, this is following, of course, after the, it kind of continues on the theme from chapter 19, that Christ has returned, the victory is his, and where we left off in chapter 19, we had the beast and the false prophet, that they have both been cast into the lake of fire in verse 20, verse 19. And but verse number 20, the first thing we're going to be introduced to is Satan's punishment. So far, we've seen, you know, those that were prepared to fight against God, prepared to fight against the coming of Christ, that they have been slain. The fowls of the air have gathered to eat them, to devour them, to get rid of their carcasses. But the one person was left out of those verses is Satan himself. What will be his fate? Well, it's not an eternal fate yet. And this is what's going to happen is we're going to see his capture and his imprisonment. So chapter 20, verse 1. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he lay hold on verse 2. And he lay hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. Verse number 3. And cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled. And after that, he must be loosed a little season. So what we have here is Satan being captured, him being restricted, imprisoned, incarcerated for this 1,000-year period. So he's out of a job for this period. He is not going to be active until the very end of this millennial kingdom period is what the main emphasis there is. Now, let's look at some different things. A bottomless pit there. I don't believe that this is the same lake of fire that we just saw in Revelation chapter, or that we're going to see, excuse me, that we're going to see. Yes, I have. This is not the same place that will be the eternal fate. I think this is our concept of hell. This is a temporary holding place, a temporary jail. This is the illustration I like to give of this is that is more of like a county jail, and that the main prison, the state prisons, like an American judicial system, and that this is, you know, he's just being locked away for a short time in the temporary holding place in the jail. He's not yet been sent to the state penitentiary, where actually you would already see that the beast and the false prophet, they've already been judged. They've already been sent onto the lake of fire. But this is not the lake of fire. It's the bottomless pit. It's the same that is mentioned back in chapter 9, verse 1, I believe, where it talks about a star falling down and the locusts, what I believe are like demon-type creatures coming out of hell itself. So that's what this place is, and we can go into a lot of detail on that with the idea of bad angels and angels being restricted and imprisoned, and we will cover that in chapter 9. Hopefully, as you're listening to this, you've already heard me cover that, but maybe eventually I'll get around to actually recording that. So, verses 2 and 3, there are two important things. Number one is that Satan is imprisoned and not allowed to work. We've emphasized that. And the second thing is that this is for 1,000 years, this millennial kingdom. That's where we get the term millennium being 1,000 years. So, this millennial kingdom lasting 1,000 years. Those are the two important points you need to remember as they are key elements of this period and setting up what's about to be described. Verse number 4 through 6 will describe this millennial kingdom, what's going on during this. And like I said, this is really the only detail given of this time period, where we have verse after verse, chapter after chapter in the Old Testament to talk about this period, talk about how wonderful it's going to be. These are the only 3 verses that really talk in any kind of detail about what's going on. It's actually very little. So, verse number 4. And I, that's John, saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. We'll go ahead and read verse 5 and 6 also. But the rest of the dead lived not again until the 1,000 years were finished. This is the first resurrection. Verse 6, blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such the second death hath no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Okay, so what we have here. This description is really not about what's going on. It's more about what we are going to be doing, what the saints are going to be doing during this millennial kingdom while Christ is ruling and reigning. And we'll see here that there's even a little key element here that's left out. In verse 4, it says, they set upon them. Well, who is they? Well, it's never particularly defined here. We see later on in verse 4 talking about martyrs, which I believe are the martyrs of the tribulation period that we've already met before, that these people are among them. I don't think this is totally just the martyrs of the tribulation period, believers from that 7-year period that will be ruling and reigning with Christ. I believe this is going to be the saints of all ages that will be included in this. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 12 is not the correct verse, it looks like. Okay, don't you love it when you do that and you put down the wrong verses? 1 Timothy 2, verse 12. And I'll just ramble as I look. Nope, that's not it either. I have no idea what that is supposed to be. So, anyway, but there are other verses that talk about us ruling and reigning with him, and I'll have to fix that in the notes, so excuse me. So, there is added with this, so we're defining who these people are, this they. I believe it's believers of all ages, of the church age, probably even going back to the Old Testament, the Old Testament saints. I think they're included also. So, what are they doing? Well, we have this idea of judgment here, that they are... it says, and judgment was given unto them. Well, what is that? This will be part of the setting up of the millennial kingdom. If you go back to Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46, we have a scene that's laid out there that is a judgment of the nations. And I think that's partially what's going to be involved. Partially, this will be ruling. And there is also in Ezekiel chapter 20, verses 33 through 38, talks about Israel itself being judged. So being a part of that, being a part of Christ's government, of his establishment, in setting up and in even probably in maintaining that government will be key elements of this, which is going to lead us to another question that we have here is, okay, well, who are we judging? Who are these people? Are there more people than saints? Yes, there are regular old human beings, just like me and you at this point, not having been translated into heaven and received a glorified body or anything like that. There will be some people that go through the tribulation period and enter into the millennial kingdom. Now, who are they? Probably, at least in one sense, we can pretty safely say that there will be some believers that do not taste death, that are not martyred, who do carry on into the millennial kingdom. There is a possibility that maybe some other people who are not believers that do. It's really kind of a little bit of a gray area. We have quite a description in the previous chapter talking about how those that fight with the Antichrist that support him are going to be slaughtered. But there will be normal, what I call normal, human beings during this time period, and that's who's being ruled and reigned. And that's going to be key here towards the end of this, towards the end of the millennial kingdom when Satan is loosed, that there are people whose fates have not been decided that still have that opportunity to choose between good and evil and heaven and hell and to accept Christ and to reject him. That's going to come into play here in just a little bit. Also here in verse 4, there is special emphasis. I think that I mentioned it talks about the martyrs. I think the special emphasis there is to further drive home the point that to further drive home the point that even though Satan attempts to eradicate those that love God, those that serve him, that he is unsuccessful. Even though he may kill them, they still are here. They are still alive. They still are given authority and power. They are still... he doesn't prevent them from God's eternal plan or purpose. So even though he may end their life on earth, God's not done with them yet. So in a way, I think this is God rubbing it in on Satan, saying, yeah, you tried to stop me, buddy, but you were unsuccessful. See, look, I still have all my saints. You can't take them out of my hand. So I think that's kind of what's being emphasized here. It's just further proof that Satan has failed, that he is defeated, because even those that had his hatred poured out upon them, here they are being lifted up into exalted positions and having a part in Christ's kingdom. Verses 5 and 6 describe a couple different resurrections. The first resurrection here is a resurrection, I believe, of the righteous, that they will all be resurrected for this millennial kingdom period. And I think that's the saints of all ages, not just of the church age, but Old Testament saints also. And now the idea of resurrection, we can go all throughout the Bible on that. But that's a key tenet, number one, of Christianity, because Christ himself was resurrected. It's a hope that we have for life beyond the grave. But in the Jewish faith, it is a key thought. It's one that even the Pharisees and Sadducees would fight and go to battle over. But this chapter right here, verse 5 and 6, do a separation that there's not just a general resurrection. Not everybody will be resurrected and then decide who's good, who's bad, separating the sheep from the goats, and whoever's done enough good works gets to go to heaven. That's not the way things work. That's an invention of mankind. Here we have described these two resurrections. First for the righteous, the second is for the unsaved. That final resurrection is a resurrection not unto life, but unto death, unto the second death. So that's what we're going to get to here at the end of the chapter. Maybe a little bit of foreshadowing here taking place. But that's this idea, is that the righteous have been resurrected to glory and honor, to their reward, and the lost will be resurrected to their eternal reward and their eternal punishment and eternal damnation. So just further driving home the point that keeps coming up in the book of Revelation. It's still going to come up here in the last couple chapters, that there are two groups of people, saved and lost. Those that accept Christ, those that reject him. And this is further driving home that there is a division between these and two vastly different fates awaiting these two groups of people. Now, verse 6 closes with, go ahead and mentioning again that they're going to rule and reign with Christ 1,000 years. This millennial kingdom is 1,000 years long. And then something is going to happen. It's not really necessarily to bring about its end, but to bring about its fall. But there's something that's going to happen here that is, okay, let me explain it this way. It's not that Satan is going to cause it to end, but in God's plan and God's purpose, he is going to prove once again that mankind is sinful. Mankind will reject God, that there is no excuse for man. This is my personal theory on this, is that throughout human history, throughout the ages, there are what some people call dispensations. And I'm not a dispensationalist in the traditional sense. I don't believe. But I do think there is some truth that God works slightly different with people throughout the ages. I believe in salvation. It's always salvation by grace through faith. I believe that that never changes. But God does deal slightly different with people. I mean, for instance, Adam and Eve in the garden, God walked with them. Yet they still chose to sin, to disobey, to break the one rule they were given. During the time of Moses, God gave the nation of Israel a law, said, here's some rules, here's some commandments, here's some principles to live by. This is what you need to do. Did that type of visualization of the truth of God, I mean, actually seeing a lamb slaughtered as a picture of Christ's suffering that was to come, did that drive the point home? No, people still rejected and still turned their back against God. Christ himself, God himself, walked on earth for about 33 and a half years. And did mankind reject him? Yes, they did. They crucified him. During this age we are in now, this church age, God's given us the scripture. God has given us this sure word of prophecy that we have to go out and proclaim to the nations, to spread the gospel, to tell everyone. Does everyone listen? By all means, no. People still reject. People still turn their back on God. And I think what is coming to fruition here is that same truth, that no matter how God deals with man, mankind is still fallen, is still depraved, and there are still people, in a majority of people, I believe, that will reject God, and that only the faithful, only the remnant, only this portion, this subset of humankind will accept God's offer of salvation and accept that gift and go on to that reward and enter into those promises that God has given them. That idea of faith being acted upon. So I think what we see here is, even though Christ himself is physically on earth, even though he is here, even though he is ruling and reigning, there's no denying now they say, oh, there's not a God, we can't see him. At this time, they'll be able to see him. He's right there. He's on the throne in Jerusalem. You can't deny what he is, who he is. You can't deny his power. But yet, people will still reject him as their savior. And that's what we're going to see here as Satan is loose, beginning in verse 7. And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. In verse 8, and shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. Okay, I'm going to leave off right there. So, this is what we have taking place, is that at the end of the millennial kingdom, at the conclusion of this 1,000-year period, Satan himself is loosed. He goes out, and what does he do? He gets busy doing his job. He is doing what he's good at, what he's been perfecting through the ages: deception, deceiving mankind, preying upon those who have that hardness in their heart that reject God. And in spite of this near perfect state of the millennial kingdom, in spite of Christ himself personally being there, besides the fact that the saints of God are there ruling and reigning with him, besides the fact that the earth itself is almost a Garden of Eden-like state, there are still people that reject Christ. There are still people that reject him, and Satan gathers them up. And it's not a minority. It is what appears to be the vast minority, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea, is what verse 8 says. And what Satan is going to do is take all these unbelievers and say, who are they? Where do they come from? I think these are the children of the children of the children of the people who entered into the millennial kingdom. And given the perfect type environment that I think will be there, the elongated lifespans, I think that there will be probably millions of people. I think that it's going to not take very long for humankind to repopulate the earth, even after the drastic and tragic losses during the tribulation period and during Armageddon. So, Satan has now gathered them up. What purpose? Verse number 9. And they went up on the breadth of the earth, and compassed the camp of saints about in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. So he leads them up. They actually go to surround the capital, which I believe is Jerusalem, and they actually have the place surrounded until God wipes them out miraculously. Fire coming down from heaven wipes them out. I just realized there's one other thing I need to mention here in verse number 8, and that is the idea of Gog and Magog. What in the world is Gog and Magog? There's a lot of debate about that. Historically speaking, it looks like it's kind of an area over by the Black and Caspian Seas. Some people point to this being Russia. There's a little bit maybe evidence for that. It's actually very unclear. To put a name to this is very difficult. Linguistically speaking, etymologically speaking, the term basically means like the people. It's like the land and its people, or the people in their land, something along those lines. It's a very vague term. So, who are these people? And they've come up before in the book Revelation, but I don't know. I don't know who they are. But neither does anybody else, I think. Whatever this is one of those things, when the time comes, it'll probably be very clear. But in this point leading up to it, we're still dealing in the shadows of things to come. This is one of the many details I don't think you're going to figure out. So after this final rebellion is squashed in verse 9, and after the defeat of Satan and his and those that have chosen to follow him rebel against Christ at the end of this millennial kingdom, what will happen? And that's going to be the last few verses here of this chapter. Verse number 10. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and false prophet are, and shall be tormented day and night forever and ever. Okay, here we go. We're getting back to, this is not the bottomless pit where Satan was bound. Now he is cast into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the final, the final, I won't say dwelling place phase, but the final fate of those that reject God. It is not hell. It is this lake of fire, which, okay, is it hell? Is it like hell? It's not specifically. I think hell is something different. I think hell is temporary. This is eternal. And this is a place of everlasting torment. And once someone goes to this point, this is their final estate. They are done. They will be forevermore in torment, in pain, in torture, in agony for their refusal to turn to God. Okay, verse number 10. So Satan himself is now joined in verse number 10 with the beast and false prophet that we saw at the end of the previous chapter. Verse number 11. And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the heaven and earth had fled away, and there was found no place for them. So here we go. We're setting up this judgment. A great white throne is the imagery here. Now, I'm going to go ahead and point out this is not judgment of saints. This is judgment of the lost. And we'll get into this real quickly, go in a little bit more detail in a little bit. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself in this detail. But what are they being judged on? It's really twofold. One is, are they saved or lost? And they are all lost. None of them are going to be found in the book of life. They are all lost. So then, on top of that, it is then going to be a judgment of their works, which there seems to be. I don't think you go out on a limb, but I think there you can make a case that their future torment will be in some way based upon their evil works. So that the most wicked person ever may just have it harder than what we would think of as a good person who still rejected God. either way, it's going to be horrible. Say this is not an idea of who goes on to rest in peace and who goes on to torture and torment. No, all these people are going into the lake of fire. All of them are going into that eternal punishment. But it does look like the fates may be slightly different, even still inside of there. Okay, another key thing here. It talks about from whose face the heaven and earth fled away. Earth and the heaven fled away. Sometimes I get these words and phrases mixed up because they sound more poetic if you reverse them. So, or I've heard a song or something like that, you know, that has it reversed. But in this case, they see these people there, or we see that the earth itself and heaven have fled away. I have a theory. I'm not so sure that what's taking place here is the destruction of the universe. I'm not sure, especially when you see how the next chapter begins. I'm not sure that existence as we know it, the universe as we know it, is destroyed. There are verses, 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10 through 11, talk about the elements being melted away with a fervent heat. And I think this may even be in connection with that fire that goes down in verse number 9. That there may be some kind of connection, but that we see that the earth, the heavens, are going to be purged, burned away with fire. And to the point that in chapter 21, we have a new heaven and new earth. Now, is that the old earth recreated? I don't think so. I honestly think that the curse of sin is so prevalent, not just in mankind's heart, but even in the world. Go back and look at what the curse did even to the environment and to the animal life and plant life. It had far-reaching effect. I'm not sure that the entire universe. Think about it. Go back, read the first chapter or two of Job. Satan himself has some ability, some, I don't know, right to be in heaven right now. That he can go in, and there's even verses that talk about, you know, war in heaven and Satan being cast down. And so think about it. Satan himself has had access to heaven, that even that beautiful sacred place has been polluted by him, by his presence. So maybe this is gageology here, but I'm not so sure that all this earth, heaven itself, all of it's not done away with, and we get a totally new universe in chapter 21. That's just kind of my opinion. Okay, let's go ahead and finish this up. Four more verses. Verse number 12. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. Verse 13, and the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them, and they were judged every man according to their works. So, this is what we'd have is called the second resurrection that we saw referenced before in verses 5 and 6. This is a resurrection. Once again, this is not saved people. This is the lost. The saved people have all already been resurrected. These people have just been in, go back to my example with Satan of the temporary holding cell. They have been in a temporary prison until they've been sent to where they're finally going to carry out their sentence. And that's what's going on here, is that these people are being resurrected. They're being judged, like we just discussed, to go on to their eternal fate. Let's see here. Verse number 14. And death and hell were cast in the lake of fire. This is the second death. The second death. And I'll point out to you in John chapter 3, Jesus tells Nicodemus, it is God, but Jesus tells Nicodemus, you know, you must be born again. And I'll point out to you, you either get born twice or you die twice. Either you are born again with that spiritual birth and become a new man in Christ, or you die twice. This second death is one that the saved, the righteous, will have no part of. This death, this second death, this spiritual death, is pointing towards those, it will be those who reject God, who reject Christ, who reject the gospel, who hate God, who fight against him, who work against him. All the lost of all the ages are included right here. And then number 15, one of the most sobering verses describing this. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. That at the end of all this, at the end of this judgment, with a note of finality, everyone who is not saved, everyone who does not belong to that subset of human beings, which is the rest of humankind, they are all included here. Anyone who rejects Christ, anyone who does not heed the gospel call, is in this group. What is their fate? Do they get another chance? According to the scriptures, they do not. They've had their chance, they've rejected God, and now it is time for them to face their punishment, to face the results of their choice, results of their sin, the results of their rejecting God and his love and the gospel and the shed blood of Christ. So that whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. And this really is a note of finality. The same theme's going to pop up in the next couple chapters of the saved and the lost, this division of mankind into two groups. But is practically speaking, at this point, the lost have gone on to their reward. They have been judged for the final time. They've gone on to their final home, the lake of fire, the place of torment, a horrible, terrible place. They have now gone on to their reward, and they are done with. Everything that's going to take place as far as future goes here, there's going to be some description talking about saved, lost, division. But what we look at going forward with the new heaven, the new earth, is looking at the reward of the saved in a world, possibly a universe, according to my gageology, that is untouched by sin. The very presence of sin is gone. The deceiver himself, Satan, is gone. And there will be no presence, there will be no power, there will be no more penalty for sin. All that is done away, and we will be in a state of perfection going on. So there we go. That is chapter number 20. I hope it has made some sense to you. And like I say, for 15 verses, there is so much packed in here. We could go on for hours just on the millennial kingdom. We could probably go on for hours on the judgment. I think we've done well enough to at least introduce the subject to you. If you're interested in those, I really, really would recommend doing a study on the millennial kingdom. It is a fascinating study with the promises in the Old Testament that are given related to that. So next time, Revelation chapter 21, the new heaven and the new earth, the state of bliss, the state of perfection that awaits the saints of God. So I appreciate you listening. Hopefully we'll get that done here. As soon as I give this time to save, I'll start recording that. I thank you for listening. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you.